Each of us is a complex being, part body and part mind. Our actions are a result of a complex of motivations, some clearly understood and some unrecognized. It is because of this, the complexity of the human condition, that lived wisdom concerning life, can rarely be reduced to simple statement. There are more things on heaven and earth than can be dreamt of in our philosophies. And it is to that basic assumption that wisdom is seldom capable of simple, clean statement that I would dedicate these reflections tonight. Yom Kippur began many, many centuries ago as a ceremony of purgation in ancient Israel. It was a time when sin offerings were sacrificed to God. According to the book of Leviticus, on Yom Kippur, two he-goats were brought as the sacrifice, the sin offering to the temple. One was sacrificed immediately in order to purify the altar. The other was placed before the high priest, who took his hands and spread them over the head of the goat. And in so doing, he recited a ritual formula of confession in which he sought to absolve himself and the community of their guilt. The burden of Israel's sins was placed upon the head and shoulders of the goat, which was then driven out of the sanctuary, driven out of the city gates, driven into the wilderness, bearing with it the sin of the people. The people felt themselves cleansed, purified before God. Now, this ritual of the scapegoat, or the Azazel, was obviously a highly dramatic ritual, one which visualized for our fathers the basic themes of Yom Kippur, the taint, the burden of guilt and sin, the efficacy of confession, the forgiveness of God, that wonderful sense of release which we have when suddenly the channels of communication with a one-time friend have been unblocked. They were again at peace with God, forgiven. Felt cleansed, purified, and renewed. Now this ancient sacrifice was offered for nearly 1,000 years, as long as the sanctuary, the temple in Jerusalem, remained standing. And when the Romans destroyed the temple in the first century of our era, our fathers continued to participate, at least in a vicarious way, in this ancient ritual, for the chapter in the book of Leviticus, chapter 16, which details the ritual, continued to be read in the synagogue on Yom Kippur as the Torah portion of the day. And so, at least in their imaginations, our fathers were able to participate in the catharsis, the release, the unburdening of the weight of sin, to feel again the purification, the cleanliness which comes to one who feels renewed. And then early in our century, the reading of this ancient historical record was abandoned. We tended to put behind us, at least in the liberal community, all memory of this ancient rite. It was a time when men insisted on relevance. And obviously, the sacrificial cult had had ceased two millennia before. It was irrelevant. It was a time when men were determined that above all else, Judaism, religion, must be intellectually respectable, easily and clearly explained. And obviously there were overtones of sympathetic magic, superstition, if you will, in this ancient sacrificial rite. It's a time when men and women were happier with religion as a kind of ethical exhortation, when they wanted to have little truck with the mystery, with the ritual, with the mystical. It was a time when people wanted religion to be reduced, as all of life was, they desired to have it reduced, to a few simple truths. They wanted to clear away, they said, the thicket of underbrush which had grown up, the folk customs and the folk ways, these ancient historical memories which were no longer relevant, so that modern man could clearly perceive the cardinal central truths of the religious tradition. And so around the year 1920, this prayer book was printed with a new reading from the Torah for Yom Kippur, several paragraphs from the 29th and 30th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. In those chapters, the Bible presents to us Moses' valedictory, his farewell address to the community. In that speech, Moses draws together the basic themes of his ministry. It's an excellent, embracing moral exhortation, a rousing sermon, fit, entirely fit for Yom Kippur. And then Moses reminds the people that they are now bound to the covenant, to God's law. And he tells them that this law has been clearly stated to them. It's not unnaturally difficult. It's not a law for saints or for monastics. It's a law for ordinary men and women. It's not too high for you, too difficult for you. And he goes on to dilate on the consequence of obedience and of disobedience. The covenant is fraught with consequence. If you are obedient, if you do your duty, then when you enter the promised land, God will allow you to endure on the land. He will be with you in all that you do and cause you to prosper. But if you fail in your duty, you will not long endure on the land that you're about to cross over to possess. And then, perhaps pointing a finger at the assembly, Moses tells them very succinctly that the choice is theirs. Hine ha-chayim va-mavet natati lefanecha, ha-bracha va-klala, u-bacharta ba-chayim. Behold, I have placed before you this day life and death, the blessing and the curse. Choose life. Choose to be a human being and not an animal. Choose love and intelligence and not lust and mindlessness. I know of no simple command which better sums up the core of Judaism teaching than these two Hebrew words, uvaharta b'chayim. Choose life. Don't choose to exist, to drag yourself along, getting and spending, living without purpose. Choose to live for some holy purpose. Choose to live a consequential life, a life which is high-minded and devoted to great ideals. Choose industry over lethargy. All work and no play may make Jack a dull boy, but all play and no work keeps Jack a boy. His talents half developed, a child emotionally. Choose service above selfishness. If I am not for myself, who will be for me may be a wise and prudent bit of counsel. But if I'm for myself alone, what am I? I'm a person who has cut himself off from friendship and from love. I cease to be a human being and become a machine who seeks to acquire, who seeks fame or wealth or some other unworthy goal. And if I achieve these goals, I am alone, encapsulated, for I no longer have any means of communicating easily with family or with friends. Choose life. Choose patience over anger. Choose sympathy over self-involvement. Choose the richness of an inner life over the simple, single-minded acquisition of wealth. Ubacharta b'chayim. Choose life. It's a great teaching. It's a bracing moral exhortation. But like all simple statements, it somehow fails to encompass the totality of wisdom, the totality of truth. You recall that it's obviously based on a concept of human freedom. It tells us that we are not burdened by some implacable fate. We are, in a way, the masters of our own character. We make our own moral decisions, not our stars, not the environment, not our genes, but we ourselves. We can do much to change life. There is reason for the confessional theme on Yom Kippur, to review our lives, to see where we have been unworthy, take ourselves in hand and to begin to reshape our lives. But with it all, there's something missing. Moses, you recall, dilates at great length about the consequences of human activity. If the people are obedient to the law, they will endure on the land. If they fail in their obedience, God would no longer be with them, and then they will not for long remain secure in the promised land. And this bit of wisdom, which somehow seems stark in the Torah portion which was chosen, I find troubling. For it is simply not true that there is a direct and observable correlation between decency and security, between the goodness of a human being and his well-being, his material well-being. Let me juxtapose to Moses' peroration the story from the Haggadic tradition, from the Hasidic tradition, rather. It's told of the towering figure of Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Levi Yitzchak was known in the Hasidic circles of Eastern Europe as a doughty and indomitable champion of the people. He was willing to ascend even to the heavenly courts, to appear before God, to dare God's wrath on behalf of Israel. It's told that before one Yom Kippur night's service, the congregation was in place. But Levi Yitzchak was seen pacing up and down the aisles of the little synagogue, obviously troubled. There were obviously some bad vibrations in the air. Finally, Levi Yitzchak, the master, the holy man, paused before a man who was seated on the floor. His knees were drawn up, his hands clasped his knees, and he was crying. "What's the matter?" The words sobbed out. "I had a good life. I had a good life until last week. No one passed my door who was hungry, whom I did not feed. My wife brought home from the marketplace any stranger who was in need of home or board. And then he took my wife from me. And he took my home from me. It was burnt. And now my six children and I are bereft. God even took from me my holy prayer book, a beautifully printed book in which every term was holy, every term was properly placed. I have nothing." Levi Yitzchak was silent. And then after a while, he called over one of his disciples and he said to him, "Find for this man a prayer book just like the one that he has lost. And such a prayer book was found, and Levi Yitzchak gave it to the suffering man. And Levi Yitzchak said to him, "Now do you forgive him?" And there was silence. And finally the man said, "Yes." And then, according to the legend, Levi Yitzchak ascended the bima, ascended the altar, and began to chant the Kol Nidre. Now, when we place this story in contrast to Moses' statement, what do we find? We find a good man, one who was obviously generous of heart, loyal in his human relationships, concerned with his family, an observant and obedient Jew, who was not secure in his life. His wife had been taken from him, his home had been burnt. What was true of this man is true of so many in life. It's simply not the case that there is a direct correlation between virtue and happiness, virtue and security, material well-being. Think of the Chalutzim. Think of the pioneers who left Europe to turn the blasted and blighted sand dunes of Palestine into a fertile land. They gave their youth. They sweated and slaved to bring water and greenness to the land. They developed on the land a fine form of cooperative living. And they won for themselves 30 years of war, terrorism. Though many successful people would like to believe that their success is entirely due to their abilities and to their energies and to their self-discipline, that's simply not the case. Luck has a great deal to do with it. Chance has a great deal to do with success. One generation graduates into the Depression and into a world war. Another generation graduates into the expanding economy and the affluence of the 1950s and the 1960s. And even when it comes to our physical health, there's no relationship between virtue and longevity, virtue and health. Oh yes, we can improve our chances by proper diet and proper exercise and immunization. But how much of our strength, how much of our what happens to us in terms of health is in one way or another a consequence of our inheritance, of our genes? Obviously, we have no control over them. Like it or not, life does not allow itself to be calculated out in the way that Moses' peroration suggests. That there is an inevitable reward, a tangible reward for decency, goodness. Now, the generation that substituted the reading in Deuteronomy for the reading in Leviticus believed that there was. They believed in progress. They believed in science. They believed that reasonable men, using their intelligence, could come together, define the problem, project research, achieve some resolution, and act upon it. There was no problem which could ultimately not be resolved by the cooperation, by the active concern of civic-minded men of goodwill. They found nothing to argue with in the simple, straightforward statements of Moses, for their lives, their philosophy, was itself simple. They believed in progress. They were hopeful, confident in their generation. Science was destroying the unknown, bringing the unknown to light. Man was gaining new powers over nature, over communication, over production. There would be enough and more, a better life soon for all, and justice with it. Oh, they were not simplistic folk at all. They didn't think of Moses' teaching or their own philosophy in terms of material well-being. They said rather that if you are good, if you are disciplined, if you do your duty, then you devise and develop a certain inner spirit calm, peace of mind. And this carries you through. This is the happiness above any price. And Yom Kippur tended to be designed by them as a kind of functional or practical spiritual exercise. A very useful thing, like an annual physical checkup. You had to have an annual character checkup. Yom Kippur was a good time to come to the sanctuary, to imagine that there was some moral grid, to try and project your actions against that grid and to make certain resolutions as to what you would do and would no longer do in the coming year. The overtones of ritual, of mystery, of communion with God, were somehow overlooked in those decades. And they spoke confidently of the usefulness of Yom Kippur. Yes, we would somehow draw together on Yom Kippur all the confused thoughts of every day. We would take these thoughts and blend them into a consistent philosophy. The confusion would disappear, there'd be a clear purpose, we would unblock all these energies, they would no longer be competing with each other, at war with each other, and we would be more capable of more confident and more successful living. Religion and Judaism were peddled in those days as effective guides to confident living and to peace of mind or peace of soul. Now, it does help to sense that what we are doing is right. And there is at times a pleasant calm within which comes to anyone who knows that he or she has met the obligations of their lives. But many of us know that we have done something that we have knew to be good and we have lived to regret it. And many of us have sacrificed much in terms of material reward for some profession of service, nursing or social work or teaching. We have sacrificed freedom for our family. And we know from our own experience that we did not escape in so doing the full measure of ordinary human anxieties and the full measure of human troubles. It's simply not true that the person who leads the good life finds an ever-present peace within, that he is necessarily happier with himself at that moment, at all moments, than another. What then is the promise of Yom Kippur? When the rabbis were pressed to the wall on this question of theodicy, of the rewards that come for obedience and of the punishment that comes for disobedience, they finally were moved to say, Sechar mitzvah mitzvah. The reward of the good deed is the good deed itself. We do the right because it's right to do it. But in a way, that begs the question. Is there anything in the nature of a reward for leading the good life? Let's look again at the story told of Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Levi Yitzchak listened to the sufferer. He could not resurrect his wife. He could not rebuild his home. What did he do? He gave him a duplicate prayer book. He gave him again a tangible symbol of the presence of God and of the promise of God. He told him in act that all is not lost, that life is not empty, devoid of all meaning, that somehow, despite it all, there are reasons to do the good and blessings that come from it. And what did the old Israelite feel during the ceremony of the scapegoat, the Azazel? When it was all over, he didn't feel that he could go out and confidently gain success. He'd not been promised that in the old Yom Kippur. He felt cleansed, purified, forgiven by God. The reward was not a tangible one, but the intangible one, a spiritual one. He felt as though he could communicate again with God. He could touch again holiness and purpose and promise. Life, a useful life, could go on. You know, to live is to be bruised. Life's not easy. All of us are subject to the death of those that we love, sudden illness, to unexpected reversals, to the intrusion of random violence, to all the insecurities of the international world, which we cannot escape. Everyone is bruised by life. There's no security, and no one escapes. And for most of us, the older we are, the more experienced we become, the more calloused become our judgments. We call it prudence. The prudence and callousness are very close to each other. We come to feel that the only real judgments which we ought to make are those which are of benefit to us. What's in it for me? No one else cares. I've been hurt too often. What's in it for me? I'm not going to open myself again to another. I've been frustrated and put off and denied too many times. I'll no longer share. The older we get, the more experienced we become, the more often we're bruised, the more each of us tends to turn his vision in on himself or herself, to think of our own needs and our own wants of survival rather than of service. What does Yom Kippur give to us? Prayer book. This moment, this music. We touch again tonight all of the generations before who have come and sung these songs and praised these words, whose sacrifice and whose vision, despite it all, has created our civilization. What does Yom Kippur give us? It gives us a ritual of confession. Not simply a black, bleak listings of our failings, but the statement of possibility and of hope. There would be no point to confession if we couldn't change and reshape our lives. We can. Yom Kippur allows us to renew ourselves, to look again at life through the eyes of youth. Before we were so experienced, before we became so prudent, when we still dreamed great dreams of service and of duty, when we were still confident that the good ought to be done and it was consequential, when we still knew confidently that we could only live one way, a good way, a useful way, that's what Yom Kippur gives us, a prayer book. Sense of being clean, pure, a youthful vision. That's a great deal. Yom Kippur gives us this not in a verbal way, by participation, by congregation, through the fasting, through the sharing, through the singing. Allow this Yom Kippur to reach you and to touch you. Live it. May you find within it the prayer book that Levi Yitzchak gave to the sufferer, the presence of God, the promise of life, the promise of God, some renewed hope, and the consequence and the use of your good life.